www.thebrainfarm.com.
This is Chris Evans recording the Storage Unpacked podcast, and I'm here with Renan Halleck, the CEO of Vast Data. Renan, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. Yeah, not too bad at all. So we bumped into each other the last, 2 weeks ago?
Yes.
In London. It was great to catch up, see you in person, because none of us have seen many of us in person for quite a while. So at the time, we had a great conversation. It seemed really good to be able to get back together. So you're here with me to have a chat, just as we say in the UK, chew the cud. I don't know whether that expression translates to anywhere else, and just have a discussion about technology. But before we do that, would you like to just take a minute or so, talk about Vast Data and yourself, and give people a bit of background about the company?
Of course. So Vast Data is almost 6 years old now. We started back at the beginning of 2016. My background personally, computer science, complexity theory, cryptography way back when. From Israel originally, so Israeli military and a bunch of different startups. The last one was a company called Extreme.io, also in the storage space.
Never heard of them.
We built a block device, all flash, and those were some fun times. We were acquired too early by another company called EMC, we probably also never heard of. And that went very, very well. In fact, we were able to hit more than $1 billion in run rate that first year of sales. It grew very quickly. And I was on the engineering side, and about 3 years into the sales side of it, I decided to go out and start something new. And Vast started as a result of many, many, many potential customer conversations, trying to understand what they would need that no one can solve for them. And it started from a storage conversation because I was coming from the storage world, but very quickly it was clear that the entirety of the infrastructure space needs to change over the next couple of decades to enable new technologies above the infrastructure, to enable AI, deep learning technologies. And that's our mission. That's what we were built to do. That's what we were founded upon. And so far, we have built very interesting, in my opinion, architecture. And we've put that storage piece on top of it that gives our customers infinite access to all of their capacity. And we're now starting to build beyond that storage piece to realize the wider ambition that we have.
Great. I obviously don't want to ask you to reveal any secrets. I mean, it'd be great if you did want to reveal secrets, but I'm sure that you'll be in trouble if you reveal too many. But, you know, this discussion, I think, is going to be good because you and I chatted for a while about, you know, where things might go in that future world. And I guess we're going to talk for 40 minutes about what we think might come up, what we think are the challenges that are being met, and, you know, to a certain degree, what you've seen already with the interaction with the customers you've had so far.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the data explosion and this whole problem of the volume of data that we're seeing being created. Now, it seems to be becoming a bit of a cliche. People talk about it all the time and say, you know, we're seeing vast amounts of data. And there's the name of the company coming straight in there. You know, vast amounts of data being created. But it'd be good to understand what you're seeing from customers and where that data is coming from in terms of, you know, the types of data and the types of organizations that are actually creating it.
Yeah, so it used to be that computers could only manipulate very certain types of data, usually machine-generated data in terms of numbers, rows, columns, etc. And what we're seeing as of late is that a lot of natural data is not only being stored, but being analyzed. And so pictures, video data, satellite imagery, genomes, sound, LIDAR information, things that flew in through some type of analog to digital converter, whether it's a genome sequencer or a camera, are being stored, are being kept forever because these new advances in analytics are at the cusp of being able to generate insight from them. And so we don't want to waste any information that we have. And as a result, we now cannot choose between fast access to a small amount of information or slow access to a large amount of information. We need both. That, I think, is the most exciting part about this next wave of innovation that we're seeing.
Okay. You touched on some of the different data types there, and one thing I think is quite interesting when you look at those is that people assume on and use the term unstructured data.
Yes.
But actually, all of the different types of data you just talked about there are highly structured. You know, they're coming from technology that's producing something that's a very complex object that has to be analyzed. And I'm guessing, you know, it's not just a case anymore of saying, well, we're searching log files and things like that. We're doing really advanced pieces of work on very complex pieces of data that are, I guess they are structured, but not structured in the old-fashioned sense of that word.
Right. They're not tabular. I think when people talk about structured, what they really mean is tabular, which these types of data are not. But coupled with new deep learning algorithms, you can extract features from them. And then those features belong perhaps in a more traditional database that you can search and query. And then indirectly, you're building a model of the natural universe that becomes more and more accurate over time. And you're using that same information also to train and to build a better and better AI model. And then you can infer over and over on all of that accumulated information to gain insight from this new type of data.
And in terms of volume, clearly, I remember, I was looking at some documentation. I was doing a bit of cleanup on a folder, and I was looking into documentation and seeing things like, I think it was the first EMC 1 terabyte array and things like that, and then thinking we would deploy something that might have, say, 300 terabytes in it, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Yep. Whereas now, we've gone past the petabyte mark when we talk about technology, and we're going even further than that. And are you seeing customers that are looking towards the exabyte scale of things?
We are, and we're seeing customers that have surpassed the exabyte scale, which was surprising to me. We have sold, in our first 2 years of selling the system, more than 2 exabytes of an all-flash and storage class memory system, which, again, very, very surprising. When we set out on this journey, I thought there were maybe 5 to 10 exabyte scale customers out there, most of which are governments. And over the last few years, I've met more than 100 exabyte scale customers, some of which today have more than 100 petabytes on VAST and are growing very, very quickly to put all of their information on VAST. And so exabyte is definitely the new petabyte or terabyte, depending on how far you look back.
If you look back at that and think about that, not just from the capacity perspective, but you looked at it from the concept of where people are putting their data, before they came to you, and obviously they want to put their data on your platforms, but where were they doing it before? Were they running huge environments on premises, or were they trusting the cloud for this sort of stuff? You know, what were you seeing typically, do you think?
Yeah, it depends on the size. So usually customers, especially new organizations, would start in the public cloud when they're small in capacity and in performance requirements, etc. And once they reach a certain size, usually around 1-2 petabytes, it becomes very, very difficult, both from a management and from a cost and from a performance perspective, to stay in the public cloud, and the tables tilt towards something that is more under their control. They would still manage it as if it is a cloud on the private side, but they would be a lot more thoughtful with respect to what data goes where and which compute belongs where and how to make those decisions in ways that benefit their business.
And have you seen customers that have taken data from tape and put it onto your platform? Because I would say that tape has been best used as an archive platform. And we tended not to use it as backup, particularly because we'd moved on to disk systems. So you would think there must be a lot of data that's archived that's been left on tape that could now be brought back in into that process.
Yeah. So our mission, one of our missions as part of building this new architecture and system on top of it, is to annihilate the hard drives. We think that the only reason the hard drive still exists today or still existed until a few years ago is because of price. And if we can, through new architecture, new algorithms, new metadata structures on top of that architecture, build an all-flash and storage class memory system that has all of the benefits of random access, performance, resilience, scalability, ease of use, but also breaks that price-performance trade-off and allows us to effectively give capacity at a price point that is competitive with the hard drive, it doesn't have a reason to exist anymore. And we are seeing customers displace very large hard drive based systems with us day in, day out. To a lesser extent, we have seen customers also displace tape-based systems with us, although to do so without incurring a higher cost, they do need to go through a more elaborate TCO calculation. But the benefit that they get is that suddenly all of their data is accessible. And so we've had a large media and entertainment shop take 100 years of footage from their archive that was on tape and leapfrog over the hard drive and put it on our system and start analyzing it through AI mechanisms and start to monetize a lot of that information. And so many times they're able to, through this newly found access to information, turn their data from a cost center to a profit center overnight.
I think one thing you've highlighted there, which I think is really interesting to think through, and that's that you talk about TCO side of it, but actually, you know, you could draw a diagram, I guess, that shows tape being super low cost, super high capacity, potentially with a very poor access quality because of the way that you have to read the data off the tape. Going through hard drives, which have got a slightly improved access quality, going to the all flash systems, which have got a very high access quality because of the way that they're accessed. And when you overlay the fact that a lot of this stuff, as you've just been explaining, really does need access to the entire data set to make it practical, you realize that actually having stuff on tape isn't giving you any value whatsoever. There's no way you can do anything with it, and therefore there's just no point doing that.
That's exactly right. And when you need access to all of your data and it's not predictable in what you're going to read when, then different types of caching and tiering also doesn't help you. And so you really need to make that leapfrog onto an all-flash system. And usually it's cost prohibitive, which is why we focus most of our energy on how do we make it cost effective for organizations to move to the all-flash data center.
So we'll come back and talk about techniques about how people are accessing data in a minute. But I just wanted to talk about Edge for a little while because, you know, before we started recording, we were having a quick chat about what that could mean, because I think Edge can be one of these things where people have their own definition, their own view. And the only reason I thought it might be an interesting angle to this is because clearly you're looking at building a very centralized, enormous pool of data that can be accessed consistently. Whereas a lot of companies might have a lot of data spread out across many, many access points or other types of technology, and therefore be looking at whether it makes sense to centralize or whether they should push some of the compute out to that edge. You know, what have you seen people doing, and what do you think the sort of the situation of that is at the moment?
So I'm a big believer in distributed computing. We do a lot of that here at VAST, and I'm a big believer in moving code rather than moving data. There's the concept of data gravity. And once you can run your applications on more than one CPU at a time, then the leap from that to distributing it geographically is still a leap, but it's a much easier one to take. And so I think, especially with advances in containerized infrastructure and microservices and orchestration frameworks, once you couple those with smarter storage systems that are multi-geography and that can understand where each container is running and what data it needs access to, you can do a lot of interesting things in scheduling the application, not across time, but across space, in a way that makes it a lot more efficient than if you needed to move data across the globe from side to side.
I think you touched on it as well already, Renan, when you said about the types of processing that are going on in that instance. So if somebody's taking, say, a video image or a still photograph and doing some sort of analysis on it, if you could push some of that work to the edge so that you were pre-processing it before you decided whether that image was useful for you,
yes,
or whether you needed to pull some parts of that image out and use it elsewhere, you wouldn't necessarily ship the whole image to somewhere centrally, process it, and then do something with it. You could do a bit of pre-processing at the edge, which is an interesting way of thinking of where we might be headed.
That's right. And also from privacy concerns, for example, if you have images coming out of London, you can't necessarily ship them over to California in order to do processing on them. But if you have a distributed compute engine where you can run a single process across both London and California, and just move the results back and forth. It's a lot more efficient from a bandwidth perspective. It's a lot safer from a privacy concern, and it just makes a lot more sense. So if that infrastructure layer can abstract that away from the application in a way that it doesn't need to think about it, then everybody wins.
We'll talk about some of that data-centric side of things in a second, but let's go back to where we were earlier when you were talking about techniques used to process data. And I'm really sort of fascinated by some of the stuff that's coming out, because a lot of the work we're seeing tends to be focused around GPUs, and everybody talks about AI and ML and, you know, those terms, neural networks, you name it, they get bandied around quite a lot. But in reality, it seems to me that they are really the core of where we're headed. A lot of the future is going to be based on that type of technology.
I think so. I think these AI technologies, whether you call them neural nets, or machine learning, or deep learning, they are a new form of computation. If you look at the way infrastructure was 10 years ago, you had VMs and backup systems and Oracle transactional databases. You're still going to need those, but 10 years from now, you're going to basically see AI supercomputers. And I think there's a journey that we're on, and sometimes we jump ahead of ourselves. Gartner has the trough of disillusionment. I'm not sure where we are on that journey, but computers are definitely at a point where they can now do the sensory part of what humans could do before. They can see, they can hear, they can probably not smell so much, but understand natural information closer and closer to the way that humans understand it. And I think the leap, again, from that to having thinking machines may be a big one, maybe a smaller one. But once you get to a thinking machine, it's game over. You don't need anything beyond that. And so I think it's justified that we're putting all of our resources at building infrastructure that is enabling that next wave. And I think we will be surprised at how far we can take this in terms of what's possible.
I think we'll all be blaming James Cameron if we end up with Skynet at some point in the future. Bearing in mind, we knew about that in 1984. You know, we should have been avoiding it where at all costs. But no, I think I can see your point. And I think, you know, we've always talked about that ability for machines to actually manage things for themselves. I remember having a magazine, I think it was in 1984-ish, and it was advertising a software product called The Last One, which was now something that was going to write all our code for us. I remember thinking, well, I can't quite say that yet, but we're probably getting pretty close down that line where we're not writing our own code in certain instances because we can self-generate that and not have to worry about it. So, you know, it sounds to me like you're saying we are pretty far down that line. At least we're heading that way quite quickly.
I think we're heading that way more and more quickly. And the more organizations we have working on the different parts of that stack, we have obviously the hardware vendors working on GPUs. We have vendors like us working on that middle of the sandwich infrastructure part in software. We have the application vendors working on life science, genomics, medical imaging. We have financial institutions taking advantage of all types of information coming into their systems. It's really exciting. It's a really, really exciting time. And every week, every month, we read about and see advances that things that our customers are doing that we didn't think were possible just a short time ago.
You can never be surprised by the creativity of a customer to take something, a piece of technology, and do something with it you never thought you could do yourself.
That's right.
And I think that's always a really magical thing when you think, or you see something and you think, wow, I never thought of that. And then, you know, the customer comes up with something very clever. Let's just go back on that for a second and talk about the GPU technology, because I'm really interested to see what your opinion is and how this landscape will change. I'll give you an example. Last year, NVIDIA came out with this technology. They hadn't released it yet. It's got another year or so to go, called Grace, which is going to be the combination of a CPU and GPU.
Yep.
And we've also seen the ability to use GPU Direct to bypass the CPU and not actually push data through the CPU. And it seems to me that we're starting to see a breakdown of what you might class as the traditional von Neumann architecture of a CPU and memory and bringing data into memory and processing it. And we're starting to see this sort of being, I guess, manipulated into different styles of architecture that are a bit more hybrid. You know, how do you see that going, and what do you think we're going to see going forward on that?
So More generally on the architecture, I think things are getting flipped on their head. If before you had an application and it was reading data, whether from memory or from storage, in order to manipulate it, and then it was writing the result that it understood to be the case. I think the more and more we're going to see data-driven applications. The data itself, as it flows into the system, will trigger functions that need to be run on it based on different characteristics of that information. And then you'll have a recursion of more and more functions that need to be run as a result of what we understand on this specific piece of information as we compare it to the rest of the data that we already have stored. Specifically with respect to GPUs, I think the term GPU is a misnomer, the graphical processing unit. They're not being used for graphics as much anymore, at least not in the world that we're in. And they're being morphed into a chip processor that can do more and more of the heavy lifting of AI workloads, whether that would be inference or training at the hardware level. And so some people call them IPUs now, intelligence processing units. Some people have brought to the forefront a new type of chip called the DPU, the data processing unit, which many times serves as a partner to this GPU. I think there's a real renaissance in compute, and specifically in compute hardware. And it all boils down to the end of Moore's Law. Because we can't make the transistors closer and closer, we need to think of more clever ways to continue down that exponential curve. And that's what's happening. And specific to VAST, in the same way that we took advantage 3-4 years ago of new hardware pieces like storage class memory and low-cost flash and new protocols like NVMe over Fabrics to build this new day's architecture of ours, disaggregated, shared everything, we are now working with our hardware partners like NVIDIA on these new DPUs and GPUs to build the rest of it. And so I think there's a lot that's changing. And definitely whenever the underlying technology changes, that introduces potential for innovation on the layers on top. And that's what we're taking advantage of now.
Yeah, this is probably the most interesting part, I think, of certainly hardware. It's certainly the most interesting part, storage, at the moment. And that's that distributed way that we potentially can manage data in different processes. Just, I guess, stepping back, and for anybody who's not really 100% aware about what the different technology is and what it does, obviously in the classic design, you know, we'd have a beginning, a middle, and end to a program. And, you know, programs would start and they would do something, then they would finish. And that data would come from some sort of persistent media into memory and be pushed out again. But obviously things like the GPU are there to accelerate some of that more complex mathematical functions that you couldn't necessarily do very easily within a central processor, but also to do that in an incredibly parallel way. And then the smart NICs come along and actually sat in the data path potentially. Some of them are offloaded engines, which some people call accelerators. But effectively what they're trying to do, as you said, is disperse this compute and split it up and divide it up into different ways we can do it quicker or we can do it more efficiently. And I think that's where it's going to be very, very interesting, because we're going to break down the sort of traditional architectures and we're going to start having things like edge computing where some of these devices are at the edge and things like that. And just even in the conversation we've had, you can start to see how a new type of architecture would evolve that you might call a data-centric architecture, where all of this sort of comes together.
That's right. That is exactly right. I think we're seeing the data center transform into a computer, and the network is becoming the new bus. And it's very, very different than it was even 5 years ago. The trade-offs are different. The way to architect changes based on where you have more capacity, less capacity, more bandwidth, less bandwidth. And a lot of interesting things can happen as those values change.
And how much of this can we do if we haven't got all of our data in one place? You know, at the end of the day, if we've got data that's in chunks in different places, I guess one of the reasons why you're in business in the first place is because so much of this requires you to be processing all of this data consistently and repeatedly. And if you can't do that, then you're not necessarily going to see the value out of it.
And there's the philosophical question again of what in the same place means. Is it in the same CPU core or a GPU? In most cases, whenever you're trying to do something that's of any significant magnitude, the answer is no. And once you cross that chasm of it's across two cores or two GPUs, then maybe it's across 1,000 or 10,000. And then why keep it in the same data center? Why not have it geographically dispersed? And as networks become stronger, what is really the difference between two computers sitting next to each other on the same rack, or, of course, other than the speed of light, two data centers that are a few towns across? And so I think, yes, as we improve in these technologies, you can geographically disperse. And the more the smarter the infrastructure gets, the more it will hide from you that distribution of the data and of your applications. You won't even know where a piece of your code is running. It'll just run closest to where its data is at any given point in time.
So it sounds to me like if we try and predict where we think we might want to be in the future, we think of the future as being miles away, but actually the future could be a couple of years. It could be, you know, just 3 or 4 years, the speed that technology iterates. It sounds to me like there's a few things that we need to put in place. So from the discussion there, it sounds we might need better data protocols. We might need better ways of managing the consistency between locations and sites. It sounds like there's still quite a bit of middle layer, if you like, protocol work and other things to go that sit above the hardware, but I have to try and solve some of those challenges.
I find that the best way to predict the future is to think...
Is to create it, isn't
exactly.
it? Isn't that the expression?
It is. And we need to understand how we would like it to be and then try and understand if that's possible. In most cases, that's the hard part. It's easy to say, I would like it to look like that. But then figuring out how to get there is a little more difficult. Sometimes you need to rely on technologies that don't really exist yet, and you need to take a leap of faith. But if you understand what you'd like it to be like and what it should be like, then you can create it. And I feel I always go back to architectures, because I feel like when you have the right architecture, a lot of things fall into place that you didn't even notice when you thought of it, just because of the elegance of it, just because of side effects that happen in a way that's really, really beneficial. And I get really excited when we start thinking about the fact that you can now scale capacity completely independently from performance, the fact that you can add tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of containers, all completely stateless, all with access to the same single namespace within a data center, across data centers, public cloud, private cloud, edge, into the device in some of these cases. And that's where we want this to go, and that's what we're working on making sure that happens. And so when you look at it top down like that, then you start to very easily see what type of protocols do we need to make that happen? What type of compute do we need in order to enable those types of architectures? And the ones that are existent that we can use, that's great. Wherever we find a gap, we'll try and develop what makes the most sense.
Let me ask you a bit of a leading question then, because you mentioned Extreme IO at the very beginning of this, and that was very much hardware-based when you were looking at building something where you had the benefit of flash. I mean, we didn't have flash before the 2010s, and the volume that was that we had from 2010 onwards, say, you know, approximately. I'm not going to keep us to exact dates. But then, you know, very obviously, you've talked about the VAST architecture not really being deliverable until you had persistent memory that was reliable and large-scale cheap flash in the form of QLC. So far, I can see two examples where hardware's driven the technology to bring it forward. So do you think that that next step will be hardware? Will it be GPU, smart NICs, and things like that will drive you to that next level, simply because you'll look at it and go, we can now do something with this we couldn't do before?
I think so. As I said before, I'm a big believer in when the rules of the game change, when the constraints, the underlying constraints are different, it opens up cracks and potential for innovation at the higher levels. And so I really like, whether it's hardware or software, for example, NVMe over Fabrics is another piece that we're relying on that is mainly software. Containers and orchestration frameworks like Kubernetes are another piece that are enabling what we're doing that are entirely software. But when the underlying technologies, whether hardware or software, change or become existent, then you can suddenly do things that you couldn't do before. And when you're on the sidelines waiting for those things to change, such that you can jump into the arena and say, now I can do this. I've been waiting for this for 3 years. I've been waiting for this for 7 years. I've been waiting for this for 15. And when it all comes together in a way that allows a new architecture, that's when it's time to start a new company. And that's the reason we started Vast. We thought there was something that needed to happen, and this was the time where it could happen. If we were to start Vast 4 or 5 years earlier, we couldn't have built what we've done. If we were to start it 3 or 4 years later, we would have been too late. And so I think the timing of that is very, very
important. Super critical. So if we were trying to second guess where we think you might be headed towards and what we should be looking out for, what can you give us as clues as to what the next iteration of Vast will be? You know, what should people be keeping their eye on and looking at and thinking and following?
So I think I've sprinkled some clues throughout this conversation. I think the fact that we're called Vast Data is a big clue. We are trying to build that next generation of data infrastructure, and storage is a very big piece of it, and it's obviously the piece that we've started from because we believe that's the anchor of the data center. But over the next few years, I think people will see us expand in the storage space and get closer and closer to realizing the true vision of universal storage, of our customers not needing to think about where they place their data and how much access they have to it and what can be done with it anymore. And in parallel, you'll see more and more not necessarily storage parts coming from us as well, based on feedback that we get from customers. You said before that the magic happens when customers use what you've built in a way that you didn't anticipate. I can very clearly state that all of our best ideas came from our customers, and usually when we didn't expect them. And so the more interaction we have with these organizations that are at the bleeding edge of very, very large scale AI, we just need to listen, and they tell us what to build. And
that's what you're going to do.
It is.
Yeah. So I guess the other side to that is the fact that you are called Vast Data. You're not called Vast Storage, which, you know, I'm sure is no mistake in terms of the name of the company. And really, we are talking about data here. We're talking about what you do with data rather than what you do with storage. And the two are very distinct. And I think that's, for me, that's probably where I'm thinking, you know, in the future, that we're talking about what you do with the data, not what you do with storage. And I think if people think like that, that might give them a few ideas of what to look for. And not that you've told me anything in confidence or anything. I'm just guessing and trying to hope that we might at least, you know, think some ideas out of this that we can write about in something else. But clearly it's the data side and not the storage side that's probably going to be where the future is, I think.
That is exactly right.
Excellent. Well, it's been great to have your time to be able to have a chat. It's been wonderful. And it was great to catch up with you in person, obviously, but, you know, even better to be able to spend some more time talking. If people want to go and find out a bit more about the company and understand about what the technology is that you offer today, what do we think is the best place for them to go to? Should we just point them at the website? Is there anything else you'd like to point them towards?
I think the website is great. We've put a lot of information into it in different forms. So vastdata.com, as you would expect. And you have a white paper there that goes very deep into the technology. You have a lot of videos, a lot of blog posts, as well as solutions on how to use this technology under different workloads and customer verticals. And so I think that would be the first place I would direct people to. And then if they want more, just send us a note and we're happy to always hop on a call and answer some hard questions.
Perfect. And obviously, we've got the previous recordings we've done with Howard, which were pretty good from a couple of years ago. So I'll point people to that in the show notes. And I've written about the technology as well. So there'll be plenty of things in the show notes if anybody wants to go and get all of this. And we'll add all of the links in you just mentioned to make sure we bring it all together. But for now, Renan, thank you very much for your time. Really enjoyed having a chat with you, and be great to catch up again in the future at some point.
Excellent. I enjoyed it as well.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked, or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.